Greetings, true believers. With the cultural dominance of Marvel Comics, Stan Lee has become a universally beloved American icon. But pushed aside in the conversation is legendary artist Jack Kirby, who co-created Captain America, the Hulk, Iron Man, Thor, and the X-Men, whose artwork more or less defined the look of comic books for generations, which makes Ted Anderson wonder,
Why is this not a movie?
Hello and welcome to Why Is This Not a Movie, the podcast where we look at a moment in history or a book or a story we can rip from the headlines and ask Hollywood why no one's ever put it onto the big screen. I'm Mike Vega, author and regular contributor to the AV Club. This week I'm joined by Ted Anderson, a comics writer who's worked on My Little Pony and Adventure Time, as well as his own titles like Moth Whisperer and Orphan Age. Ted, thanks for coming on the show. Tell us about Jack Kirby and why his story needs a big screen adaptation.
Oh boy. Okay. So I am obviously a comics person. I love comics as a medium. I'm also a librarian, which means I love the history of the medium and I love getting into why and where it came from. And I read extensively as a kid. And Jack Kirby is one of the guys of the comics form who is... Well, there's a lot of reasons to talk about him. I mean, for starters, he's the OG Antifa super soldier comics artist. He actually went overseas and shot some Nazis, which I think is the thing that all comics artists should aspire to. He's also one of the guys who defined a lot of the superhero form in the 60s as part of the big Marvel boom. As part of the Silver Age, he redefined what we expect from our heroes and from our characters. And he's also emblematic in the sense that, like a lot of people who worked in comics, he got incredibly shafted by the big corporations of the comics. Essentially, if you were a comics creator from before around 1985, your odds were very good that you were going to end up flat broke with no royalties to your name, kind of screwed up because you were working in an industry that never gave you any health insurance or royalties on what you created. The situation is different nowadays. Let's give credit where credit is due. Marvel and DC are no longer horrible places to work at. But Jack Kirby was a guy who created fantastical amounts of material that still resonates today, and owned pretty much none of it. And his family have had to sue for various rights earnings and original artwork and so forth just to get it back and for him to get the credit that he deserves. I don't want to demonize Marvel or DC too much. They're corporations, which means all corporations have certain things in common, but they definitely at the time had policies in place that made for a pretty unpleasant business experience for Jack Kirby. So his story is not unique. Look up people like Bob Kane and Bill Finger, the creators of Batman, one of whom got all the credit and one of whom got none of it, or Siegel and Schuster, creators of Superman. They got phenomenally screwed over on their creation. But Jack Kirby is maybe the one of the guys who created the most and got the least out of it. He also has a nicely cinematic story. So for any biopic, I mean, you gotta pick what era you want to talk about, because trying to do a full story from birth to death, open on Jack Kirby emerging from the womb, it's going to be a little much. So let's start with the basics. Jacob Kurtzberg, born 1917 in a cinematically perfect tenement of New York, one of those bricks and bottle throwing alleyways. Lower East Side of Manhattan, sounds like. His dad was in and out of jobs all the time. It was unfortunately a difficult time to find work, obviously. Jacob never had too much of an education, but he read voraciously, pulps, comics, all that kind of stuff. And of course, he drew an enormous amount as well. The legend is he was in the Pratt Institute for Art for one day before his father lost the job and he had to drop out to get a job himself. Eventually, he ended up in the comics making industry of the time, which was dominated by people like Gardner Fox, who essentially had a sweatshop of comics makers going. And he would basically do ripoffs of existing more popular comic strips, things like Dick Tracy, Terry and the Pirates, Popeye, things like that, under assumed names, of course. He hit it big at Gardner Fox, though, with a fellow by the name of Joe Simon, who was a writer who was working there. The two of them got along really well and ended up working on a number of original characters that gained some fame. Characters like the Guardian or the Newsboy Legion, or most famously, the original star-spangled defender of heroism, Captain America, who showed up on that front cover, the first issue, punching Hitler square in the jaw. Jack Kirby was not a man you could ever accuse of subtlety. Captain America obviously turned out to be pretty popular in wartime America. Kirby and Simon went on to create a whole bunch of issues of it, and then they realized, hey, you know, we're going to get drafted, or at the very least, we should go over there and fight some Nazis. They created a huge backlog of material and then both signed up to go overseas. Kirby landed in Europe a couple months after D-Day, fought his way through France. Supposedly, he was a reconnaissance guy. He would go into occupied villages and then, like, draw out a layout of the village for his fellow squadron to go in and liberate it. I don't know much about his combat record. He very nearly lost his legs to frostbite, but came back home in one piece. Somewhere along here, he got married. I forget the timeline. He was already married by the time he went to Europe, actually, I realized. Married to Rosalind, whose maiden name I've completely forgotten.
Goldstein, and he proposed to her on her 18th birthday. Couldn't wait another minute.
Yes. I believe she lived in the floor above him in the tenement house where he worked. I think that's the story. But yeah, Rosalind Goldstein, thank you. They were happily married. They were happily married for the rest of his life. They have four kids together. It's a wonderful love story. She's going to be obviously a huge part of whatever movie we end up making about about Jack Kirby. He gets back to America and he finds that he doesn't have a whole lot of job prospects beating down his door. Comics are big, particularly crime and horror comics, but so is the specter of the oncoming comics code, the backlash to comics being bad for young readers. The comics code was a self-imposed code of censorship that all the comics publishers agreed to abide by in order to ensure they would still be sold on newsstands. Things like never showing death, never showing the exact nature of a crime, never showing a divorce on panel, I think was other stuff like that. It's pretty draconian. So this obviously put the kibosh on crime comics and horror comics in particular. It also led more or less to a revival of the superhero and experimentation with different genres. Once Kirby and Simon got back, they worked together on a bunch of stuff. They created pretty much the first romance comics. Young Romance, I believe, was the title of the very first one they did, but a couple others. But they didn't find a whole lot of success. Somewhere in here, I don't know the exact date, I think it was around 57, Kirby and Simon kind of parted ways amicably. They still remained friends to the end of their days, but Simon just wanted to do different things from Kirby, and Kirby wanted to do his own thing. And Kirby found himself at kind of a low point here where he didn't really have any long-term prospects. This might be a good place to start the movie, possibly, but I think there's a better one coming on later. Kirby at his lowest point, you know, scrambling across the streets of New York City looking for jobs from people he knew from before the war. And finally, he ends up at a company called Marvel, or sometimes called Timely. Supposedly, it went by many names to evade the tax guys. Owned by a fellow named Martin Goodman and with a brash young editor-in-chief named Stanley Liebowitz, or Stan Lee, as he called himself. Stan had a vision in mind of a huge new comics enterprise, a very different type of storytelling, and Jack Kirby was already pretty well-regarded within the comics creator community, so he was a pretty huge get at the time, relatively speaking. There's also, this is interesting, there's a little bit of bad blood between him and Stan. The details of it are a little ambiguous. It has something to do with Stan essentially spilling the beans in a project he and Simon were working on back before the war to somebody who shouldn't have known about them. So there's a little bit of bad blood, or at least Kirby didn't like him all that much when he first stepped into the office. Also, another factor leading to his move to Marvel, he had just recently had a court case for back pay on Captain America issues, I believe, which he lost. And since he was, you know, married and had a family and had kids, he was looking for some money pretty hard up. So he ended up coming over to Marvel, and he did a couple monster issues and some experimental crime comics, I believe some Western comics, trying out some different genres. But then 1961 rolls around, and the first issue of Fantastic Four hits the stands, and it's a bomb going off. The beginning of the Marvel Age of Comics is a really huge shift in how we talk about superheroes and how superheroes function as mythic characters in American literature. And Marvel is a big part of that because it recontextualizes their struggles in a really interesting way. Up until now, you've got Superman, you know, the literal paragon from space. You've got Batman, the richest man in the world with all this amazing training. You've got Wonder Woman from a paradise island. You got Green Lantern, the space cop. You've got all these characters who are sort of larger than life and a little bit hard to relate to in a lot of ways. And Marvel really goes in a different direction. And there's also, this might be a little too high-minded for a big Hollywood biopic, but there's an interesting parallel in how Jack and how Stan and Jack thought about the superhero. Because both of them, I think, you could make an argument that both of them really liked looking at the intersection of, call it the human and the mythic. They really like looking at areas where mythic ideas and mythic territory intersects with human characters. They do it in very different ways, though, once they're allowed to split up and do their own different things, but we'll get to that. Stan really liked having human characters who were suddenly elevated to having some mythic proportion, and that's evident in all these really early Marvel characters. So after Fantastic Four hits the newsstands in 61, they suddenly have a string of hits in the Marvel age. They have the Incredible Hulk. They have characters like the X-Men. They have Thor come in. They have Iron Man, of course. Spider-Man was almost a Stan and Jack creation, but Stan decided that Jack's pencils weren't quite the right look for Spider-Man, so Steve Ditko took over instead. But the two of them together created a whole bunch of these characters that by now are on every movie screen in the entire country at all times. I think I could turn on TBS right now and probably watch Ant-Man or something. Ant-Man, actually, that's another Stan and Jack creation, come to think of it. They created these characters that almost instantaneously were enormous hits. There's a good potential for a running gag in here in that the owner of Marvel, Martin Goodman, famously had really bad judgment for what things were going to be popular. So he tried to cancel basically all these characters only a couple issues in without realizing, oh, they were going to be huge. So famously, he would cancel like the Hulk after three issues and then suddenly realize, oh, shit, we got a hot one here, and then bring back the Hulk. So you have something where Martin, you can constantly have Jack and Stan walk into his office and Martin's like, ah, oh, this Spider-Man character is never going to sell. And then 2 months later, oh man, we got to print every Spider-Man comic we got. It's a really heady time. And it's a time of great fame, not just for the characters they create, but for the creators themselves. One of the other things that Stan Lee is most notable for, besides creating all these characters, is creating a culture that really celebrated the creators themselves. Up until now, I'm not entirely sure about this. Up until this point in history, I don't think it was common for a lot of comics to have creators listed on the comics themselves. You wouldn't necessarily know who was writing this issue of Superman or Batman. But Marvel not only ensured that every creator got their credit, they had this bombastic style of crediting everyone involved in it. You have another fantastic epic in the mighty Marvel tradition, written by Smilin' Stan Lee, art by Jack the King Kirby, things like that. You have these caricatures of these creators are appearing in the comics themselves. There's an issue of Fantastic Four where Dr. Doom threatens Stan and Jack into bringing him back into the comic book. And then you have things like the Merry Marvel Marching Society, the official fan club of Marvel fanboys everywhere, which came with like a membership card and a certificate and a record you could play that included kind of hammy dialogue of like hanging out in the bullpen with all the guys and Stan watching. Oh, well, Jack Kirby, what are you working on now? Oh, well, Stan, I'm working on this page of Silver Surfer. That's going to be Crackerjack. It's very cheesy, but it was making them famous. It was making them hugely popular and known quantities as opposed to just the guys who worked on the assembly line. The standing joke in comics is that the greatest character Stan Lee ever invented was Stan Lee. And there's a lot of truth in that because he made himself and everyone who worked at Marvel into a real larger than life character. But this caused a lot of tension because Stan Lee was also the guy who got a lot of the credit for it. In amongst Marvel's various financial troubles, Stan Lee was seen as the one guy who created everything. There's a lot of controversy as to how much he contributed to all these various characters and how much all the artists did. And it would require some incredible precision to be able to calculate exactly how much one guy contributed versus the other. I don't think Stan Lee was stealing credit from people who deserved it more, but I also think that definitely there was much more of a collaborative aspect going on than people realize. I think there's a lot to discuss in all these aspects, and it's impossible to try and measure how much of each issue was Stan and how much was Jack. Definitely, though, Jack Kirby was creating huge amounts of stuff and in some cases scripting these issues. And as you'll see from works later on in his oeuvre, he could write a Crackerjack script just as good as anyone. So I don't think it's unreasonable that Jack Kirby should be credited with pretty much the creation of a lot of these characters. But
one thing that I think has also been, I don't know, you can't really split these hairs, is how much of Stan Lee getting credit was Stan Lee taking credit and how much of it was people naturally want to assume sort of he was the public face of Marvel Comics.
Yeah.
And if you're the public face of something, people just assume you're doing everything and they give you the credit because they don't need to parse out, oh, there's a team of 15 people making this. It's just like Stan Lee's the guy who writes the letters to the editor. Yeah. My kind of introduction to the world of comics as a kid was the Incredible Hulk and Spider-Man cartoons in the 80s.
Oof.
That would start with a voiceover from Stan Lee. Greetings, true believers. This is Stan Lee and Spider-Man's got a humdinger, you know, and it was full of his usual, like, just overexcited, you know, lots of adjectives, and he would sign off every episode too. So to me, like, that one guy, that was comic books.
Yeah. Oh, he was the face of Marvel Comics. And I think a better starting point for this movie would be at this point where Jack is realizing more and more, I'm not going to be getting enough credit for what I'm doing here. He was getting a page rate that was pretty dang good by standards of the time, as far as I can find, but it was just a page rate. There were no royalties, there was no creation credit, and there was no long-term contract. There was no health insurance. Things were not going to go. There was no guarantee that he was going to continue getting the rate that he was. And in the late 60s, I don't know exactly when, but I believe in like 67 or 68, there was a buyout of Marvel, or at least some financial something or other, in which the other party demanded that Stan Lee be included, but didn't give a fig about anyone else. And this is more or less probably going to be the breaking point for Kirby, and probably the best place to start was this idea of this guy who is externally at the top. He is creating some of the most popular comic books in America. Everybody reads them. Everybody knows who the Hulk is, who the Fantastic Four are, who the Silver Surfer is, but he himself is not getting a lot of the rewards from it. I mean, he's got the support of his loving wife and his family, of course, but he's not guaranteed any sort of financial success if he ever is to leave. And he decides eventually that is going to be his only option. If he's not going to get the credit he deserves, he might as well take his talents elsewhere. This also, I believe he moves to California at some point around this. So that might be another transition point. And the idea of starting off a movie as he's moving in the desk on which he draws his comics is the very first thing that he moves into his house, of course. And then he immediately starts drawing while they unload everything else around him. But yeah, he decides to try it on his own for a little bit, but through meeting another creator who worked for DC Comics, he switched sides. He switched to the other major publisher of superhero comics at the time, and still is the only other major publisher of comics, DC. Legendarily, when he was about to start work at DC, they had this massive publicity campaign that would just say, they had these banner ads that just said, Kirby is coming. and maybe a picture of like Superman or something. And it was all you needed to say, because of course Kirby was a well-known phenomenon at this point. He was widely regarded as the king. I mean, say what you will about Stan, and we have and we will, but he made sure that Kirby was getting these outsized adoratory adjectives at every opportunity. He was the most fantastic artist you've ever seen. He was Jack Kirby, the king of comic books. He was this legendary figure, this legendary linesmith. You know, he got all these adjectives, and to my mind, I mean, he deserves them, but that means that he had a substantial following, and that any person who was already reading comics was well aware of who Jack Kirby was. So they had these ads that literally just said Kirby is coming, and that's all you needed to see. He goes to DC and he immediately wants to do his own thing. The reports are a little muddied about what exactly he asked for. Supposedly he asked for their worst selling book and he would turn it into their best selling book. It's probably not quite that. It's more just like he asked for whatever book they would hand him, and then he would make something fantastic out of it. He gets Superman's pal, Jimmy Olsen, and he decides to create out of that very thin beginning, a modern sci-fi hippie pop culture mega epic, the modern mythology of our times, what is collectively known as Kirby's Fourth World. And this is, I think, the real meat of it, is when Kirby finally gets the restraints lifted off. When Kirby comes to DC, he gets the opportunity to create his own comic books entirely. Soup to nuts, everything on those books is by him, with the exception of the inking. But that's not necessarily a part of the creative process that he was finding is most necessary. He was writing, editing, penciling, and I believe even lettering all these books. At the peak of what he was doing at DC, I believe Kirby was doing 3 or 4 books regularly, which meant a book every, I think, 3 weeks, which is an insane pace, not only just for someone doing the art on a comic, because regular comic artists can only really do about an issue per month, but also writing them and making them into this seamless, gigantic, mega epic whole that had all these characters that would flow together into this modern mythology and this pantheon of characters. It's phenomenal. I mean, Kirby at his peak at DC was probably creating more and better comics by any one creator than has ever been equaled since. It's an astonishing amount of work. So the very basics of it, and I think this movie cannot avoid but get into some of the basics of it. Kirby starts off with Jimmy Olsen and Superman discovering some various nefarious plots, something called the DNA Project involving cellular technology and cloning and the next frontier of science and all this nonsense. But it very clearly then brings in some weird stuff from outer space, and it takes a while to really explain exactly what it is. But it eventually comes down to the idea that there are these new gods who are quite literally the new manifestation of divinity in the universe, and their war is now on Earth. The first page of The New Gods, the comic, really sums it up and is this fantastic piece of art. It's this battlefield of a dying world as the Earth shatters under these costumed figures with these strange weapons and sci-fi helmets. And then the text says, "Epilogue. There came a time when the old gods died. The brave died with the cunning. The noble perished, locked in battle with unleashed evil. It was the last day for them. An ancient era was passing in fiery holocaust." You see what I say about writing and not exactly subtle. I mean, Kirby was creating, he very clearly and very explicitly was creating a new mythology. The whole idea was that the old gods had died and all their worlds had died with them. And out of them was born the new gods, the twin worlds of Apocalypse, this blasted shell of a planet with the Armageddos and the fire pits of Apocalypse rising into the sky, and New Genesis, the saintly Edenic paradise. And two sets of gods and all their, you know, sub-godlings and various pacts that have been made, and all these plots that somehow center on Earth as the source of the anti-life equation, the equation that takes away all free thought. And Kirby is in his 50s, and this is 1970s, but he's still got his finger quite on the pulse of youth culture, in that he's creating these characters that are very clearly about, that are steeped in like hippie imagery, but also anti-war ideas and ideas of pop culture and how it relates to the infinite and tapping into the divine through pop culture and music. And it's wild stuff. It's incredibly wild stuff.
And also the old gods dying, the new ones coming up. It works as a metaphor for the generation gap that was a big deal at the time. It also works as a metaphor from him, for Kirby, walking away from this very rich interconnected world he created with Stan at Marvel, because one of the great things about this Jack Kirby era of Marvel was that there was airtight continuity across all titles.
Oh, yeah.
Which no one's ever really matched.
Yeah, the X-Men would just show up in an issue of the Avengers, but it would work from both of their issues because it was literally the same two guys creating both of them. Yeah.
There was even a thing where, like, when Reed Richards and Sue Storm get married.
Oh, yeah.
Like, one of the X-Men's arm is in a sling because he broke his arm in the previous issue of X-Men. Like, there's, yes. You know, all the details are right. And so he's walking away from this whole very rich universe he's created, and now he's creating a new universe, new gods.
Yeah, and there's even, I mean, there's a further resonance in that one of his favorite characters was probably Thor. And Thor, of course, being one of the last of the old gods, is now being supplanted by his work on the new gods. Yeah. Jack Kirby had a couple different favorite characters, I suppose. I mean, the Silver Surfer was an obvious prototype for a lot of the new gods stuff. It was this energy being from space, learning what it meant to be human. And this also, this brings in something I mentioned earlier, the idea of that Kirby and Stan both wanted to create works that were about the intersection of the divine and the human. And Stan, I think, approached it from the perspective of what if a human gains these mythic powers? You know, what if ordinary bespectacled limp wrist Peter Parker gains the proportionate strength of a spider? What if Iron Man, the engineer Tony Stark, suddenly has this problem where he puts on an iron suit and becomes this knight of old? Disabled Donald Blake strikes his staff and becomes Thor, the thunder god. And it was about the problems of the human as experienced in a realm in which they were having to battle these immense struggles and fight against these incredible enemies. Whereas Kirby, I think, took it in the opposite direction. He was creating these characters, the new gods, that were about these mythic beings interacting on the level that mortals do. So you have characters like the Forever People, who are quite literally a group of five hippies from Supertown traveling to Earth with their mother box, and they can turn into the Infinity Man, and they have all these fantastic powers, but they're basically just hippies, super strong, super tough hippies who come from a planet, from a land of unimaginable wonder, coming down to Earth and trying to experience life as we do. And Stan and Jack, when they worked together, had some really crackerjack ideas, but they also worked on the same ideas, but in different directions. This might, again, get a little bit too much into the weeds, but there was a part of the dispute about why Jack left Marvel was also there was a direction that they were planning to take the Silver Surfer in. And it kind of boils down this conflict quite neatly in that when they were finally showing the origins of the Silver Surfer, who, if you remember, is the herald for Galactus, the consumer of worlds, and wields the power cosmic as he travels the space lanes, Stan Lee wanted to make the Silver Surfer a being who had lived on an Earth-like planet, who then got turned into this being of massive power and was forced to ride through space finding worlds for his master to consume. And Jack wanted to make him a being of pure energy who had just sort of condensed out of the ether and now wanted to live as humans do. And they argued over it, and Stan Lee's idea for the origin of the Silver Surfer, of course, won out. So Jack's approach was essentially discarded, but you can see elements of that as well, obviously, in his Fourth World stuff. Again, it might be a little too high-minded for a Hollywood biopic, but it shows the difference in their two approaches pretty well, I think.
But I also I think if you're doing a biopic about, you know, comic book writers and artists, it needs to be more than guys sitting in offices at drafting tables. You need to have deeper themes, and it needs to be representative of something.
Yeah, that's going to come up when we start talking about visuals, because a lot of this, unless we do some really interesting visuals, it's just going to be Jack Kirby sitting at a drafting table for 12 hours a day.
Right, exactly.
And people in suits arguing in an office somewhere about royalties and gross checks.
Well, if I can throw in one more deeper theme I was thinking about earlier when we were talking, but the new gods, I don't know, I'm still trying to figure out how this fits into this thing, is you were talking about how the Marvel era of comics, the characters weren't these larger than life, you know, richest man in the world and, you know, powerful alien. They were sort of ordinary schlubs who were like turned into these powerful people.
Right.
The thing I was thinking of is the story of comic books is essentially inherently a Jewish story.
Oh, yes.
You know, Jacob Kurtzberg, Stanley Lieber, Siegel and Shuster. But the first wave of superheroes, Captain America, that Kirby and Simon create, and Superman, these were created before the war, when fascism is on the rise and Jewish people are being oppressed. And these are Jewish empowerment fantasies. Hey, what if there was this all-powerful guy who believed in, you know, the American way, who would fight our enemies and set things right? And so you have Superman fighting the Nazis. You have Cap punching out Hitler as the introduction to Cap. Like, that's the starting point is,
yeah,
we need a super strong guy who will stand up for us and fight the Nazis. So then Marvel 1960, this is well past the war, but this is still, these are comics still being created by first, second generation Jewish immigrants who are scrambling for a foothold. A lot of, you know, sort of the like cliche or stereotype or whatever you want to call it of Jews going into entertainment, there were a lot of other doors that were not open. If you're going to be an executive at IBM or GM or something, there was a very definite ceiling as to how high you're going to advance in sort of traditional corporate America. Whereas if you were the Marx Brothers, you could go from, you know, entertaining people on the street corner to being these huge movie stars, because that was an avenue that was open because it was purely about talent and how much you could entertain people. So that kind of fits the Marvel comics a little bit more, where these are ordinary people who are given this extraordinary chance to do something big.
Yes.
And they usually don't, I mean, some of them start off, like Tony Stark is in a pretty good place, you know, before he becomes Iron Man.
Right.
And a lot of them are scientists because this is also post Sputnik. Sputnik was 1957, and science is on everybody's mind. And it's so there's a lot of thing. There's a lot of scientists, heroes and villains.
Yeah.
But there is this kind of thing, but you can almost take the temperature of Jews in America and how they were feeling at that moment based on like the tenor of the comic books that were made. So I'm trying to think of like, does New Gods fit into this sort of theory of mine? And I feel like because it was the very early 70s, we don't think of the 70s as being a particularly optimistic decade, but I wonder if late 1970, 1971, we were still coming off the most prosperous economic period in American history and the civil rights movement. It had to feel like, oh, we're just going to keep getting better and better. Things aren't going to completely get cynical and fall apart in the next, say, 5 years. So, you know, New Gods with this going back to these mythic things, it's like, oh yeah, we're a superpower. We can tackle racism. We can tackle, you know, all these issues. And so maybe we've sort of built back up to, we don't need to write about ordinary people now. Now we can write about these grand, like, histories unfolding and grand things. But I also think it was just ambition on his part that, like, he wanted to take a big swing.
That's true. Yeah. It's interesting to think of the New Gods as how they might fit into a specifically Jewish reading of the superhero. So one thing that's actually interesting for me is that they're gods. They're called gods, but they're very grounded in a way in a sci-fi reality. You know, they live on a planet. They use these things called boom tubes to travel between planets, but they're still grounded in the sense that they have to have a device that makes a boom tube. And there's a very explicit sort of Jewish moment in the a reference to something out of the Torah in that on New Genesis, Highfather, the leader of all the New Genesis guys, who's a bearded dude in a robe and a crook stick, receives his messages as written by a flaming hand on the wall of the source. And the messages written by the source tell him about the future and what must happen and how we must approach it. And so there's an idea right there that he's not God. He's just the dude who's answering. He's a prophet. He's a guy who's listening to God and interpreting his words. I mean, they're usually pretty explicit, like, you know, must defeat dark side on earth. But it's he's listening to the words of scripture as they're being written on the wall and understanding and interpreting them.
It's almost literally a stone tablet in a burning bush.
Yeah. And that it's very it's Jewish in the sense that it's about wrestling with the divine, which is, I mean, that's one way of, isn't that, it's one way of translating the term Israel is literally like those who wrestle with God. I should say, I'm not Jewish. I have friends who are, and it's something I'm aware of, and I've studied to a degree. And I remember reading somewhere that basically, depending on how you slice it, one of the words for a Jewish person literally translates to God puncher, which is to say somebody who wrestles with God, someone who wrestles with angels and who wrestles with questions of faith and theology and the divine.
Well,
and
that's what I'm a quarter Jewish and not religious at all. And like, they don't let me touch the space laser or anything. But that's going to be dated like by the time this airs.
Oh my God. Quick tangent. I did see a tweet that said something like, please don't refer to it as the Jewish space laser. The actual term is Kirby Crackle. anyway,
but the thing I admire about Judaism is that this is constant questioning and pushing back and trying to understand rather than just blindly accepting like this is the word, you know. In fact, we did a previous episode about adapting the Yiddish Policeman's Union, Michael Chabon book. And one of my favorite scenes in that book is that the detective goes to interrogate this powerful rabbi who, is Hasidic, super religious, super serious. And he goes into this room with all these Hasidic rabbis, the most esteemed, most religious, most serious men in Jewish Alaska, which is the setting for this alternate history. And what they're doing is these are people who take the word very, very, very seriously. They're combing the Torah and the Talmud looking for loopholes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're like, we take these rules very, very seriously, but there's got to be a way around them, right?
There's got to be a way for us to continue our crime empire. Sorry, spoilers. I listened to that episode. they are basically the underworld dons of the Jewish state. And yeah, that's, they're trying to find a ways to interpret it. And I mean, you want to talk about Judaism in comics. I mean, a contract with God quite literally is probably the biggest, well, not the biggest. I don't know. I mean, you did say Superman, but it's one of those moments in comics where you realize, oh yeah, a lot of our creators, a lot of Jewish creators are grappling with this idea of how do you properly deal with the divine in the mortal flesh. You know, how do you adapt rules for living, you know, 4,000 years ago to today? How do you understand God as he manifests himself in a world that also contains the Holocaust? These are questions that require serious thought and can also be approached from a pop culture way. Thinking of specific issues of the fourth world, because of course, as soon as I started thinking about this topic, I pulled down my omnibuses from the shelf and I started rereading all these great issues, and they're completely fantastic. And it really, there's this sense of struggle inherent in it that is not part of a Christian worldview in which God knows everything and is everywhere and is all powerful. It's about this contending for the souls of people. The anti-life equation is literally that which takes away all free choice and free will and makes people into zombies, essentially. And these sides are warring over it in a way that will decide the future of the universe. And ordinary people are caught up in this struggle over who exactly gets to rule, who gets to understand the mysteries of the cosmos. You have these characters who are able to travel across time and space, but still are confronted with the mysteries of the human spirit and things like that. It would take a better scholar than I to actually write something about the idea of the fourth world as it relates to Judaism. I think there's definitely parallels there, and obviously throughout all of comics, definitely. And it's also, I mean, this is another reason why I don't really want to demonize Stan Lee too much, is because his works without Jack Kirby also show some really interesting works on that. There's a graphic novel he did with the French artist Mobius about the Silver Surfer called, it's Silver Surfer Requiem, I believe, which is sort of a standalone thing that's very explicitly about sort of what does God demand of us? What do we demand of God? How do we understand God? And how does God understand us? How do we relate to each other as beings, as entities? And it's really quite philosophical and thoughtful and quite good. And it hits a lot of the same notes that Kirby does, which may be Kirby's influence on Stan Lee, frankly. But I do think the two of them both grappled with these questions just in different ways. And I do think Stan Lee definitely had talent of his own. It's just that it's unclear where his talent stopped and somebody else's started, which is always the tricky part to try and
parse. Well, with any collaboration.
Yeah. Oh, you can't split that hair so finely. It's impossible. And unfortunately, it is quite financially necessary because, of course, Kirby is not doing so hot. So back to the immediacies of the movie production. I mean, this is a great tangent and I want to stick with it. But
well, I also think you don't need to explicitly go into a tear about Judaism in this movie, but it's good to a biopic works when there's deeper themes at work and you're not just talking about this one person's life, but this sort of his part in history and the deeper themes and all that stuff.
Right. And it's an interesting part of his life at all points because he did change his name formally at one point to Jack Kirby because of obviously Jacob Kurtzberg was his birth name, but he was eventually just known as Jack Kirby. But he did for many years resist using a pen name or a pseudonym because he didn't like the idea of being treated as a second class citizen because he had a stereotypically Jewish name. He also, I mean, he was, I jokingly described him as the OG Antifa super soldier. He was explicitly very anti-fascist. And there was a celebrated incident at one point where he's working at the draft board one day when a call comes up. This is during the war, but before he goes off. And some young punks in the lobby are calling up and say, hey, we heard that Jack Kirby doesn't like Hitler. Well, we think he's pretty good. What do you think about that, huh? And he immediately rolls up his sleeves and heads downstairs to punch the tar out of him. Of course, they've run away by the time he gets there. But you see his deep disdain for that. And also,
I don't care what era this movie is set in, that scene's got to be in there because that's one of the best stories about Jack Kirby.
Oh, it's great. It's completely fantastic. And I mean, it's also explicit in the books that he and Stan Lee did, because Stan Lee, for all his other faults, was also explicitly anti-bigotry and anti-fascist. I mean, one of the earliest issues of the Fantastic Four literally has them kill Hitler, or maybe it's Hitler's body double, this is the hate monger, because Stan Lee was also not very terribly subtle in his writing.
But anybody who's seen anybody who has a Facebook or Twitter account has seen somebody repost his letter to the readers, denouncing bigotry. He created Black Panther.
Yes.
So specifically because there hadn't been an African-American superhero and
he and Jack realized that, they didn't have any prominent black characters. And so they were, and yet they had, of course, black readers because every kid in America was reading Marvel Comics by 67. And so, that's an incident that I also actually kind of wanted to bring up because they realized, hey, we need a black guy in here. Let's make him the greatest dude in this entire comic, because from the jump, T'Challa the Black Panther is the richest guy in the world, king of this country, superpowers, super cool, always the coolest dude in the room. And in his first appearance, beats the tar out of the other Fantastic Four members just because he's that badass.
Yeah. Speaking of empowerment fantasy, it's not like, Black Lightning, we'll make a sort of second tier guy. It's like
with Black Panther, he's an Afrofuturist king. Yeah. And he's cooler than all of you put together. it's also such a
moral and sociological reasons, it's great that they create a black superhero. It's also such a great comic book concept that there's this secret kingdom of super technology and then marrying those things together. This is quite a few years after the original, their run of Fantastic Four and Hulk and Spider-Man and all these things. And yet they still could just come up with marry these killer concepts to great characters. And
oh, Yeah, it's going back and reading those. There are parts that are maybe perhaps a little off-putting. I mean, there's still some jokes about tribal dances and stuff and the Black Panther appearance. But yeah, it still feels so fresh and so important. And the idea that they come to this country that everyone thinks is just a middle of nowhere in Africa, and it turns out to be fantastically wealthy and advanced and far better than anything we've got over here. But, you know, to show that Black Panther is not just a superhero, he's a great guy, and he only fights the Fantastic Four because he wants to test them to see if they're good enough to help him, you know. And actually, one of the other bits about Black Panther in that very first appearance, so I say that he fights them and he wins and he beats them up. The actual trick is that he only brought the Fantastic Four there, but the Human Torch's friend Wyatt Wingfoot, the Native American character, snuck along on the ship because he was, I don't know, taking a nap in the back or whatever. And he ends up defeating the Black Panther by sneaking around and, you know, disabling his surveillance devices. So really, the the awesome Black empowerment fantasy is only defeated by the magical Native American fantasy character showing up. That maybe also has some unfortunate implications, but it's what happens to that issue.
Well, I think it's also, 1967. There are things that were progressive at the time that would not be viewed that way today, but it was kind of a stumble, you know, there was a stumbling towards a better representation, and it wasn't going to be
perfect from the jump.
Exactly.
I mean, even in the Fourth World, a lot of his, he made an effort. You can see him making an effort to include Black characters. They are of two of the prominent characters that I can think of in the Fourth World that he creates who are Black. They also have the word Black in their name. There's Viking the Black and the Black Racer. So it's baby steps.
one bit of comics lore that I would love to dig up is the first African-American comics character that didn't have Black in their superhero name.
Oh, that's good. Ooh, I don't actually know.
Like maybe Storm?
Maybe Storm. Well, actually, I don't know when the Falcon debuted, because I know the Falcon was a major part of Captain America from...
Oh, yeah.
I don't know when. I've seen examples, incidentally, of... I've seen like some scans of pages of the Falcon when Jack Kirby went back to writing him, and there's a couple points where he shows up, and he's very explicitly making jokes about, like, yeah, you know, back in the day, all those American guys you talk about, I would have just been the house slave. And it's very pointedly like, oh, yeah, American wasn't always great for everybody. It's really, you know, kind of... It's openly interesting about that. So yeah, apparently, according to Wikipedia, 1969.
Yeah, we're just looking this up, and Storm wasn't until 1975.
Yeah. Giant Size X-Men number one, baby.
God bless Wikipedia. This whole podcast is an offshoot of my AV Club column where I write about like odd Wikipedia pages, which is just an excuse for me to just like dig up cool stories and weird stuff. But
yes.
And then people in the comments for that column, I would tell a story and they'd say, why is this not a movie? And I heard that enough times that I made this. But it is such a tremendous resource, and I don't know how old you are, but I'm 46, and the internet was like new to me. When I got to college, I had email, this thing that no one had ever heard of. And so the promise of the internet back then was that this like sort of scientists and great minds could share knowledge and stuff. And then it all became sort of porn and video games. But Wikipedia is that promise. Like really, the wealth of human knowledge is just like, we can just, when did Falcon join Captain America? Bam, 1969.
There we go. I have to say, incidentally, Steph only told me that you were a writer for the AV Club, which was exciting enough. But then I realized, oh man, he does the Wikipedia for the Wiki Marvel.
Oh, you've read it. That's great.
Yeah, I love them. Getting back to the Fourth World, the tragedy of the Fourth World is, of course, that it was forever unfinished. Jack Kirby got to do all these books for a while, but there was a number of factors leading to a contraction of the comic book market. There was the shift to what's known as the direct market, which meant selling more directly to fans, but it made it much more difficult to get it to people who are not already fans. That combined with the fact that for all of this tight continuity meant it was a little bit harder for new readers to get into the Fourth World stuff. And Jack's stuff was unfortunately not selling as well as they wanted it to. And DC ended up closing it out after a few years. I forget the exact date. Probably the last issue was on sale, something like 1975 or 1976. And that was obviously a huge blow, because he had in mind a grand mythic ending to this grand mythic opera. He had this massive conflict built up between Orion, the master of the Astro Force and secret son of Darkseid, but raised on New Genesis. You know, they had all these, you know, grandiose titles. And of course, there was going to be this epic clash of good and evil. And it never comes. It never happens. He gets let go by DC. Or maybe he leaves specifically. I forget. I believe he leaves his contract when he's given the option. And from that point on, it's kind of the end of old school Kirby. Well, it's the end of an era when he gets to create whatever the hell he wants and goes off on it. From that point on, he does still do comics. He even reunites with Joe Simon at one point to do an issue of something. It's a revamp of an old character. I think it's a revamp of the Sandman, but that never goes anywhere. He does a few sample issues of this character or that character. They never get picked up. They do two or three issues and then they peter out again. He's still widely recognized, but he's thought of more and more as Jack the Hack. He's no longer Jack King Kirby. He is now old, behind the times, get with the times, grandpa. This is how we're doing it now. And he sort of fades from existence for a while. And the unfortunate part about this is that, well, the unfortunate part for our purposes is that this means there's not an easy way to end the movie, because there's no single defining point that really is a natural closing to this movie. The best that I can find is that, so Jack essentially leaves comics by 1978. He's still doing stuff occasionally, but he's no longer the regular creator he used to be. I believe 1978 is the first year where there was not a comic with his name on it on the stands at some point. He gets into occasionally doing stuff for animation. He's living out in California, so he's closer, because he's closer to the animation studios. He does some sketches for movie proposals. One of the great celebrated weird side incidents is he did the proposals for a movie version of Lord of Light, which is another fantastic book that should be made into a movie by Roger Zelazny, which is never made, but those same sketches are used by the CIA team that did the Argo job, where they went into, what was it? They were freeing the hostages from Iran.
Yeah,
those like storyboards and sketches he came up with were used as fake. I think it was like for a fake amusement park that was never built. as cover for the CIA team. It's some weird story that only, you know, only in comics, folks, except it wasn't comics. Well, whatever. But yeah, Jack essentially, and he, at this point, his health is failing as well. He has problems in one of his eyes. He has a stroke at some point that gives his hand, his drawing hand, a tremor that really makes it difficult for him to draw. And eventually he just has to kind of start suing people for the back royalties that he's owed. One final point that might be worth pointing to in his life is in 1989, when he finally wins a lawsuit against Marvel and they return a whole bunch of his old artwork, something like 2000 pages that he could finally sell off as, you know, mementos and start making bank off of that. But yeah, there's an anecdote about it in the biography of Kirby that is quite poignant, quite heart-wrenching when you realize, oh yeah, this is what his life has amounted to. He has no ownership over any of these fantastic characters, and he's got a box of 2,000 pages of comics he made and his memories. From there, things do brighten up, because the thing is Kirby's legacy obviously is much bigger than the man himself, and he, for years afterwards, would go to Comic-Con in San Diego, and he was always awarded a standing ovation from all people assembled. He was again the king of comics. He was highly regarded again. Stan Lee, of course, always spoke highly of him in public, even when Stan Lee the company was essentially not giving Jack Kirby the royalties, and Stan Lee the person was still always cordial to him.
That's your ending, that yeah. he's sort of professionally and financially disillusioned and sort of feeling like he's at a low point. And then he gets invited to Comic-Con, he gets up on stage, and like everybody's cheering for him, he's a superhero, and you get to go
end on that happier note. Yeah, that does work. Yeah, I think that having that moment of recognition where he realizes, oh yeah, people do recognize it. Because one of the other things that he kept saying, and that people have recorded him as saying about things like The Fourth World, is that people will get it. It will be famous in its own time. People will understand what I was trying to do. And it's true. I mean, there's a reason that his books now are so widely reprinted and why everyone regards him as the king. It's because they understand now what he was trying to do. He was years ahead of his time and trying to build this incredible overarching mythology entirely from whole cloth, from one guy's imagination. Even Stan Lee and Jack Kirby working together weren't trying to create one interconnected world. They were creating a whole bunch of superheroes who happen to all live in Manhattan.
Right, you know?
But he was building this immense tale of good and evil that still really resonates. I mean, it's hokey in places. The costumes are weird, but the costumes have this irreducible Kirby charm to them. And of course, the dialogue is as goofy as all get out, but it has this incredible charm to it. Once I pick these up, I cannot stop reading them, because there's this beautiful madness to all of them. There's these crazy images and these weird side tangents that it goes down. There's a great issue that includes a guy who is widely agreed to be Jack Kirby making fun of Stan Lee, the con man, Funky Flashman, who is just constantly taking credit for everybody else's innovations and, you know, putting on disguises so his creditors don't recognize him and things like that. And it's, you know, it's just always madcap and brilliant. And he's so much smarter than I think anybody ever gives him credit for.
And one thing that I don't think we have talked about is how much he really defined the look of comic books. Mm. And because he had this energetic style where, like, characters standing still look like they were, you know, ready to leap into action. But he also very often, you know, comic books is about putting art in little boxes.
Yeah.
And he really was the first person to just break the plane and have characters reaching past the panel and sort of off the page. And
oh, yeah. Yes, there are some. I mean, look at a generic Jack Kirby cover from any time in the Marvel age or later. And generally, there will be a person on the front of the comic reaching out at you or jumping out at you or sometimes jumping away from you. But he constantly is breaking that level of the he's breaking the motion. He's breaking the sense of the panel being a flat, static plane. He's making these characters so dynamic. They're literally bursting off the page and reaching out at you. And yeah, even when his characters are not moving, they still have this poise to them, this look that they're about to jump into battle, and every gesture is melodrama isn't the word for it, but they're dialed up to 11. They're exaggerated in such a way that everything just bursts with life. He has his signature way of drawing energy, for example, the famous Kirby dots. Yeah, it's his the lines that he used. Well, that's partly based off of the inker he was working with, but the lines, the way that colors and blacks blend together on his pages are just, it's electric. It's really incredible.
All right, well, I think we're at the end of his life story.
Right.
So who do you see directing this movie?
I have to admit, I'm not as big of a movie person as I perhaps should be, given my background. My father was a film professor, and yet I still cannot remember directors. But the one name that has bubbled to my brain recently, because I just saw the movie, it was Armando Iannucci, who just directed the David Copperfield film starring Dev Patel, which came out over the past year, which is phenomenal. And David Copperfield, I think, is a good comparison, because as much as it is just a story of a guy in Victorian London kind of muddling about and getting things happening to him and meeting strange characters, there's a huge sense of playing with the medium in that movie. There's characters reaching down through in other environments. There's characters who are painted to blend in with the background or some way hide themselves behind the edges of the frame. There's a sense of play inherent in that movie that I think works really well. That being said, I really don't know directors, so I don't necessarily know if I'm suggesting the right person.
Well, he also created Veep and The Thick of It and In the Loop and
right.
All these things that are sort of people in an office working together while also being dicks to each other. Like,
yeah,
that could have a, you know, relevance.
That has
there.
An energy to it. Yeah. But yeah, what are your suggestions? Because
I had two, and it's basically, is this a big budget movie or a small budget movie? But they're both directors, and maybe this is on the nose, but you kind of want somebody who is into comics, understands comics, and has an interesting way of presenting things. Mm-hmm. And so my two thoughts were Edgar Wright.
Oh, yes.
You know, is such a big comic book guy and also just has so much visual flair, and that he could do the interesting visual things with this. And I was thinking specifically Scott Pilgrim versus the World, which is so comic booky and video gamey, where
yeah, it's, sound it's effects got are this, appearing on the screen, and yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's like a comic book up on screen, as it is. And so I feel like he could, and he can make flights of fancy that don't seem gimmicky and seem really part of the story and part of the character.
Yeah. So, and he's also, he plays with the form on a smaller level that I think works with Kirby stuff too. I mean, there's that famous sequence where in Scott Pilgrim where Knives Chow opens the door or goes to his apartment door and Scott like hides behind the door frame as his roommate hides him, and then he jumps out the window, and it's playing with how much you see behind the door. And it's a very small thing in a movie with a lot of wild special effects going on, but it's something that shows an understanding of the frame, which is something that's common to both comics and movies, albeit in different ways.
Oh yeah. And he puts so much thought into the visuals in his shots, and that is such a sort of Jack Kirby analog. So he might be the best choice, but I also had Shari Springer Berman and Robert Pulcini, who are a team of directors who have done maybe a dozen films, including American Splendor in 2003, which was a biopic of Harvey Pekar.
Yes.
And so if you wanted to, you know, they've done sort of one of the most important figures in indie comics. If you now wanted to do one of the most important figures in mainstream comics, they could kind of return to the well as like a spiritual sequel.
That would be an interesting comparison. I mean, the advantage, as it were, of making a movie about Harvey Pekar is that so much of Harvey Pekar's material was Harvey Pekar.
And
Jack Kirby, he did one vaguely autobiographical work later in his years that was just sort of a generic tale of growing up in a Brooklyn tenement. It was 8 pages. It was called Street Code. And you can see, you know, oh, this is probably his life story, but he never really did that much about himself. I mean, I think you're right in that American Splendor, obviously there's a lot of thematic parallels, and there's people who know how to work with comics as they turn into movies. But yeah, Jack Kirby, it's difficult to imagine him turning into any of his characters, except maybe The Thing. Actually, that's a pretty good idea. Something like that.
Well, on that note, It took me a long time to come up with good actors to play Jack Kirby because he's, you know, he's an artist, he's an intellectual, but he's also the guy who like punches out Nazis in the lobby of his office building. Like, and yes. If you look at him, he's this like square jawed, like
fire plug of a man. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's like 5'2 and 175 pounds. He's a brick.
Yeah.
I was looking at a picture of like him and Joe Simon and him and Stan Lee, and he's always like a foot shorter than his collaborators, but he's got that solidity to him. And the name that actually immediately popped to mind when I first looked at a picture of a young Jack Kirby, and it was a very weird comparison. He looks a lot like Oscar Isaac. He has kind of, yeah, he has sort of the same heavy eyebrows and like really intense eyes and the square jaw. Yeah. But I feel like it would be more appropriate to have him whenever possible played by a Jewish actor, just because I feel like, as you said, I think his Judaism was very important to him, albeit in ways that were not necessarily seen in the comics he created, just because, I mean, this is the pressures of the market in post-war America. He didn't want to make characters explicitly Jewish in a lot of ways. And for many years they weren't. I mean,
it's like, he's Jacob Kurtzberg, who changed his name to Jack Kirby professionally. Like,
right. There's elements of his life that aren't as public, I suppose. But I do feel like it's something important enough that when you consider what he looks like, you'd want to consider making him, you would want to consider casting specifically Jewish actors, just because I think there's a neat symmetry to it. And one of the ideas I had is also, for a movie like this, you would want to talk about, you know, not just his biggest works, but also his future and his origins. And it might be a thing where you have Jack Kirby at three different ages.
Yeah, that's true.
So I had a couple ideas very early on where I realized, oh, the man to play old Jack Kirby is Chaz Palminteri, well known from The Usual Suspects. Yeah, he looks exactly like, I mean, it's uncanny. He's got that thickness, that square jaw, the really heavy eyebrows. You could definitely see him. But as old Jack Kirby specifically, he's only in his 50s by the time that he's doing the Fourth World stuff, which I think is where the meat of the story would take place. Yeah, so you want someone.
Chaz Palminteri is 68.
Yeah, you could do it with makeup, but I feel like he might be better as an old, or the other name that actually left to mind, and this is a bit of an odd one, and you'd have to do some stuff hiding his height, but Daniel Day-Lewis could maybe do an old Jack Kirby. he's much taller than Jack Kirby ever was, and he's definitely not as wide, but like, obviously Daniel Day-Lewis is a chameleon. I think you can put him in pretty much anything.
Oh, yeah.
But,
yeah. My thing was, he's 23 when he creates Captain America. He's 40 when he meets Stan Lee.
Yeah.
And so I was kind of looking for somebody around 40, maybe late 30s, because I figure we want to capture maybe him coming into Marvel, maybe a little bit before that. And I hadn't thought about doing different actors for different ages. You could, if you want to spend enough time in different parts of his life, then maybe that makes some sense.
Yeah.
But I think you kind of get somebody in the middle and age them up and down.
As necessary. Sure. Yeah. Makeup does wonderful things on screen. So the names I picked a bunch of names for people who I thought could convincingly do him at various middle ages. The name that I think that I came to last, but I feel like probably hits him pretty close in spirit as well, would be Sacha Baron Cohen, who's also Jewish and who has a certain, his face doesn't have the same structure, but he has a certain energy to him that I think could really fit with Jack Kirby's. There's also, I mean, someone like Joaquin Phoenix, Jake Gyllenhaal, or even James Franco could have something of that air of Jack Kirby's authority. And I don't want to say anger, but he has a force to him. And everything I've seen of him, he's solid and he's always looking off to the horizon.
Yeah, I actually had Jake Gyllenhaal on my list too for that reason.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that. Thank you. I was worried I was picking too many high profile people. I wasn't sure if they would really fit, but yeah, those names for some reason, I mean, they're Jewish actors for one thing. Again, I really feel like that's important. As a possibility for a younger actor, I'm not as familiar with this guy, but the name Logan Lerman came up as someone who kind of looks like a young Jack Kirby. He was in Perks of Being a Wallflower and the Percy Jackson movies, the ones that are supposedly not that great.
Right.
He has something of that look to him, and he would be like the Jack Kirby who creates Captain America, who meets.
Yeah, he's 29 right now.
Right,
and he looks like he's 23.
Right, I think he could do a good young Jack Kirby as necessary. So that's our Jack Kirby.
Yeah, that's pretty good. I had two more names that I'm actually less sure about than some of your ideas, but they don't quite have, neither of them quite have the same physicality as, you know, that sort of fireplug Jack Kirby, but I wanted somebody who could seem like they were an artist and intellectual, but also had a toughness to them.
Yeah.
And so I had James Wolk, who he was the closeted salesman in the later seasons of Mad Men, Bob.
Mm. And Bob.
Yeah, and he was the politician on Watchmen, and was great in that. And you could.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he's a little more of like a leading man looks than Jack Kirby, but it's all, you know, it's a movie.
Yeah.
And this one, I just, it's maybe a little too meta, but Andrew Garfield.
Yeah. Weirdly, you know, He came up as well when I was thinking about it. I was like, you know, Andrew Garfield kind of has that look. He's got the brows. He's got the brows for it.
Well, that's it. He had a little bit of the physicality. He can play the tough side, but he's also believable as an artist.
Yeah.
And has a sensitivity to him. And it's weird to have Spider-Man playing Jack Kirby, especially since it's one of the only Marvel characters Kirby didn't have fingerprints on. But
yep.
but he kind of works.
Yeah. No, I could definitely see Andrew Garfield. Yeah, okay.
So who do you want to do next? The only other real names they had as the key players in the story were Roz Kirby, Joe Simon, and Stan Lee. So I don't know. Do you want to do Roz and Joe, and we'll save Stan for last?
Yeah, because Stan obviously looms so large. Rosalind, I thought a little bit about the idea of the same way of doing younger and older portrayals. The younger portrayal, the one who would be with him throughout the bulk of the movie, I was thinking maybe Allison Hannigan. I like her a lot as an actress. I haven't seen her a lot sort of headlining anything recently. And I mean, to be fair, I don't watch a whole lot of movies. I'm not as up on my...
No, she's one of the fun things about doing this podcast is pulling up actors you like who could use more work. And she's definitely in that category.
Yeah, I like her a lot. Rosalind didn't have... I'm trying to think how to put this gracefully. She doesn't have a super unique physicality to her. There's no like, oh, you have to get the jawline right, or oh, you have to have someone with this kind of eyes. She doesn't have a specific look to her that requires you to get this type of actress, which means you can kind of give it to whoever you think could give a good performance as this person who, I realize I kind of skipped over her role in all this, but she was a constant companion to Jack. She was his rock in everything he created. And also, famously, she was the sort of personality model for the character of Big Barda, but not the physical model, as you might imagine. Big Barda, the 6-foot-tall super soldier from Apocalypse, who was saved by love by falling in love with Scott Free, Mr. Miracle. She's this, you know, Amazon of who walks among men and yet is madly in love with this guy. And apparently Roz was always his model in terms of her personality for that character. So someone who has a certain force and can bring a certain level of energy to that role, I think would be crucial.
Oh yeah. Not really knowing that much about her other than just what little I've read, that she and Jack are both very generous with their time with fans and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But just in my head, I feel like you kind of imagine Jack Kirby being somebody who is a match for him intellectually and, you know, just as force of personality. So I had Lizzie Kaplan mostly because she's about the right age and I like her, and she does look a little similar. She's just somebody who I could see as being, you know, kind of a smart, assertive counterbalance to him. And he's...
Oh, yes. I know. Okay. I didn't recognize the name, but I like her a lot. She was in... God, that's right. She was in Mean Girls. Oh, I love her.
Yeah.
Yes. All right. Yes. Excellent. Yes. I know who you're talking about now. Yeah, that works. Yes. She's phenomenal. And she really, like you said, she has not had... Oh man, yeah, she could really do. She could really make a meal out of that role.
That's the thing. She's great in everything. And I also think because this is really kind of a story about the men, like, you know, we're working together.
Yeah,
you want an actress who you want a like no small parts kind of actor who is going to make Roz as memorable as she should be, and not just be sidelined as the wife.
Yeah. I did, when I was writing down names, I kind of half jokingly, half seriously put down as an older Roz, possibly Barbara Streisand, who has acted in the past, has been known to go up on the screen. I don't know. I was trying to think of prominent Jewish actresses who I thought could make a really, you know, good role out of this wife who supported her man through all these trials and tribulations. I don't know. I thought it would be funny. Yeah, you can maybe cut that bit.
But it's fun to do stunt casting sometimes.
Oh, yeah. So for Joe Simon is a person who, again, doesn't have a hugely defined look, at least in all the pictures I found of him. He's got kind of a thin, drawn face. He doesn't have a whole lot of physicality. He seems to be, what I read is that basically he and Kirby were about the same weight, and he was about a foot taller. So he's like 6 feet and 175 pounds. He's not exactly Mr. Universe over here.
But also with him, the public doesn't really have a great sense of what Joe Simon looks like or even who he is. So I think you have a little more leeway, whereas like Stan Lee's very recognizable. You want somebody who looks like Stan Lee, but I didn't know what Joe Simon looked like until I looked him up researching for this.
And if, as I did, you look up Joe Simon on Google Images, about half of it will be the blues singer Joe Simon. One of the contemporary pictures I found of the guy reminded me a little of Zach Braff. He was a guy that I like in a lot of things, obviously starting with Scrubs, but he had a couple media roles earlier in the 2000s, and then I haven't seen him as much, and I like him a lot. And I like him as someone who I've always felt that as much as he gets by in a lot of manic energy, I feel like there's an understatedness to a lot of his performances that I really would like to see in a guy who was kind of the understated one of these partnerships. You know, he remained friends with Kirby even as he walked away, and he was always sort of the mild-mannered one. I believe he worked in, like, maybe movies and just writing other characters, and just kind of led a pretty quiet life, as far as I can tell, apart from all the drama of comics.
Well, the thing that I kind of hung my casting on for Joe Simon was that while he and Kirby were working together making comics, on the side, he also published Sick, which was a competitor to Mad Magazine.
Yeah, that's true.
So I feel like he's kind of the comic relief to some extent. Not maybe the comic relief, but like he's the lighthearted one in this partnership, and Kirby's he's the serious Nazi punching guy.
Oh, that's a good
point. Simon's the jokester. Yeah. And so for whatever reason, I landed on Nick Kroll, who is a few years older than our age range for Kirby, and Simon's a few years older than Kirby. And it just seems like he's probably a comics guy.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah, that works really well. He's, like you say, I mean, I hadn't thought about playing him as the comic relief, but it does make sense. I mean, Kirby he was known to be a funny, genial guy, but not necessarily the joke-telling one of it. But the guy
Not even the comic relief in the movie sense, but just in the dynamic.
Sure. Yeah, oh, that's a good cast. I like that. I like it a lot. I did have two other people just who could potentially come in, one of them I don't even have actors for. I just thought they should get a role in it. The first one is Martin Goodman, the publisher of Marvel, who I thought sort of had something of a comedic role in that he's the guy who pretty much had terrible business sense for the actual comics he was producing. The name that I kept thinking of just because it was so similar, and then I looked it up and I'm happy to find out they actually kind of resemble each other, is Martin Freeman. maybe a stunt cast. You bring in Martin Freeman playing Martin Goodman as the guy who doesn't have any idea what he's buying up. And he kind of looks like the guy. You know, why not give the guy a role? I like him a lot.
And he's good at playing the befuddled everyman.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's where he made his bones. Yeah. The other person who I feel should maybe have a prominent role, but I don't know who this would be Flo Steinberg, who was the only woman in the Marvel bullpen. But I think her role is larger than that because, I mean, she, like I said, Stan Lee was making celebrities out of everybody in the Marvel offices. Flo was one of those people, probably because she was the only woman and she was Stan Lee's assistant. But she was one of the other faces of Marvel Comics who lasted for years, which she died in, I think, 2011. I'm not sure. There was a massive outcry. She was, you know, widely beloved. I just feel like she should have at least some sort of role. I don't actually have anyone who I would think of as playing Flo Steinberg, but again, like you say, this is a story about the men, and I feel like it's important to have representation for those women who were sort of standing out to the side watching all this nonsense.
Right, but, as it were. But we're still there. We're still part of this. And
oh, yeah, and who shaped it, too. I mean, she wasn't a passive observer of all this. She had her own role in all these various correspondences and getting everything put together. So, yeah, I feel like she should have at least some role. I'm trying to think of who she reminds me of, but no one's coming to mind. But
well, I'm pulling up Google Images, and half of the captions say "Fabulous Flo Steinberg," and I'm just take a guess who had appended that adjective to her name and stuff.
Yeah, she's one of the founders of Marvel in a real way, and I feel like if possible, some good actor should have a role. So,
oh yeah, yeah. All right, so that leaves Stan Lee.
That does leave Stan Lee, and boy, oh boy, Stan Lee is a crackerjack casting challenge.
Well, he's such a larger than life figure, and he's also somebody that, thanks to the Marvel movies, everybody knows what he looks like. Before you get to your suggestions, the internet has a suggestion. Because in doing the research for this, I've seen a lot of suggestions that Marc Maron play Stan Lee.
Oh, obviously. That, you know,
yeah,
that's such an obvious... I can't believe I didn't think of Marc Maron.
Yeah, especially on
Glow.
Pictures of him on Glow, where he's got big sunglasses and he's got a mustache and not the soul patch.
Oh, that really is exactly...
The only problem is he's younger than Jack Kirby, and Marc Maron's 57. Stan was 35 when he and Kirby started working together at Marvel. So if you're doing a later in life thing, but I feel like the meat of the story is the years that they're first working together and maybe the couple years before that.
Right. That is the difficulty of it. Like, Marc Maron is a perfect 70s Jack Kirby. Like, Jack Kirby. This is how tightly tied together those two people are, is that it's I'm constantly confusing them. I mean, Stan Lee looms so large in this story. He's not necessarily a villain. I would not want my fictional Jack Kirby biopic to make him the demon in this creation story. He's a challenging figure.
They have a complicated relationship, which is more interesting than him being a straight villain.
Oh, exactly. I mean, there are apparently several times when Stan Lee, as a person, would say to Jack Kirby, "I'm sorry, I can't do this thing for you. I can't make the company do this." When Stan Lee, the company, was essentially a billion-dollar company. It's really difficult to think of who might be able to play him convincingly as well as sympathetically, because he deserves sympathy for his roles. even as he also deserves to be shown being the businessman and the hype man that he is. I was trying to think of a later year Stan Lee, and I realized that Alan Alda has a certain look about him that, like, playing Stan Lee within the last, like, 20 years, he could do that. Yeah. But a younger Stan Lee, I realize now, I'm looking at my list, I realize I actually had Andrew Garfield playing young Stan Lee. Like, young, you know, in his 20s. Yeah.
But, I mean, Andrew Garfield's 37 now.
Right. He could maybe do a modern Jack, or modern. I mean, he could maybe do a Stan Lee at that time. When they're working together and during the Marvel age. But I feel like, I don't know, someone with that high forehead, those glasses, it's not quite a soul patch. What exactly is he? He doesn't have a goatee. He just has the mustache at that point.
Yeah, I think he only ever had the mustache.
Okay.
I can remember.
Yeah, so I had Alan Alda as old Stan Lee and maybe Andrew Garfield as the young Stan Lee, but I didn't really have a Stan Lee for that particular slice of time. So I'm curious to know who you came up with, because I was kind of striking out.
Well, I started with Marc Maron because I saw that on the internet, and that was kind of hard to shake. But he's too old for, I think, the meat of the story. But also, Maron always plays a curmudgeon. By his own, like, accounting on his show, talking about his acting, he doesn't have a lot of range. Mm-hmm. He basically says, like, I can do this one thing, and so I do, you know, I do this in every thing that I'm in. Whereas that's not Stan at all. You have this kind of gonzo optimism and enthusiasm. At least that's the persona. But I feel like they're probably. Wasn't a lot of Stan Lee behind that persona. I feel like he put most of himself into that. I don't know that for a fact. Yes. I don't know the man, but like, I feel like there is, like, the persona was Stan Lee. So with that as the thing I was looking for, like somebody who has that kind of hype man energy to the point where it's kind of annoying.
Yes.
I came with Max Greenfield, who was Schmidt on New Girl.
I never saw that. Let me look him up.
He's a little bit of a physical match for not what we think of Stan Lee as looking as, but what younger Stan Lee, yes, you know, like in his late 30s looked like. And so if you're going to focus on that era when they're creating all the legendary Marvel, you know, heroes in the 60s, he's exactly that age. And he's just got this, like, you know, sort of not boundless energy as much as
irrepressible.
He's just, yeah, exactly. He's like bubbling and overflowing with energy, even when you don't want him to be. And that seems like that's kind of the essence of Stan Lee.
Oh, completely.
At least from Kirby, from Kirby's perspective.
Oh, yeah, and that's the thing is Kirby, I think, definitely seems like the sedate one in that partner. Well, the sedate one when you talk to him. I mean, all the anecdotes I read about Kirby when you're hanging out with the guy is he had kind of flights of fancy. He would jump around from topic to topic in his conversation, but not in a distracted way, more in a way where, like, you would have to go back later and make the leap and be like, oh, he had a really good point about this thing and that thing. And he was difficult to talk to sometimes, whereas Stan Lee was dominating the conversation. I'm looking at a picture right now on IMDb of Max Greenfield, and, like, this sounds weird, I cover up the top half of his face with my thumb, and he looks exactly like Stan Lee with that long chin and that huge smile.
I was surprised once I put him side by side with young pictures of Stan, how much of a resemblance it was.
It's uncanny. And yeah, I feel like that energy is more important than the looks exactly, because one of the unfortunate truths is, yeah, as you said, everybody knows what Stan Lee looks like. Right. You cannot meet a person in the United States today who does not know what Stan Lee looks like.
But also, you can do hair and makeup or whatever to make him look more like Stan, more than you can change the energy that he brings to the role.
Right. And yeah, I do think from what you've said about Max Greenfield, and I'm trying to see if I knew anything else about him, but from what I know about him, which isn't much, but from what I know about him, absolutely. Yeah, that seems like exactly the right person to give that role to.
Yeah, yeah, I don't know what other things that are big that he's done other than New Girl or since New Girl, but he was really the breakout character on that.
Yeah, that energy is going to be all consuming because it is going to be a story about Jack Kirby struggling with various forces, and some of those forces are going to be personified and some of them are going to be more metaphorical, but Stan Lee is going to be one of the forces that he grapples with on a regular basis. And that's the bigger truth. That's one of the bigger truths that I want to get to here is Jack Kirby was also, he was a smart man. He knew exactly what had happened to other men in comics who had tried to make it big and who had occasionally failed. He knew about, for example, the story of Bob Kane and Bill Finger, the two creators of Batman, one of whom got all the credit and all the money, and the other of whom died penniless in a pauper's grave.
Yeah.
And took years for his family to get any sort of recognition. And so he was not unaware of the degree to which Stan Lee was dominating this personification of Marvel and what that meant for his potential future. And it's difficult to talk about him without recognizing that so much of his work went unrecognized in his life. And it's heartbreaking to think that so much of what he could have done and was never given the great recognition it deserved at the time. But at the same time, he left us with so much. Like I said, at the peak of his career, he was producing more comics pages in more roles, not just art, but writing and doing the lettering and everything else, than I think anyone else has ever tried to do since without breaking their hand in three places. It's an incredible amount of work for anybody to do one comic regularly. He was doing three and all the art and everything.
It seems like he knew how much the deck was stacked against him and decided he was just going to work twice as hard as anybody else.
Yeah. Every anecdote I have read about him and his wife is that basically she would come out, she would, you know, say goodnight to him. And he's like, oh, I'll just stay up till 1 a.m. finishing a few pages. And then she would come out at 6 a.m. the next morning and he'd still be there. And he's like, oh, it's half past one, right? And she's like, no. Yeah, he was a workaholic until, unfortunately, his later years, which is partly why I wanted to avoid these, because by that point, he really couldn't draw at all. And it was a struggle for him to even sign his name. But I feel like you're right. Ending on a scene of him finally realizing that people do recognize him as the king, it's heartwarming for him to at least recognize that that happened, because it did within his lifetime. He did achieve the recognition that I think he always deserved within his lifetime. And I think it's important to recognize that occasionally the community recognizes it even when nobody else does.
Oh, sure. Yeah. And yeah, I don't think you need to see him as like an infirm anymore. I think you want to go out on that high note.
Yeah. And then you having brought up the influence of his Jewish faith, I think that's something that also would want to be covered in there, but it's difficult. I don't know to what degree he ever went to temple. I don't know how religious he was. There's a famous sketch he did in 1975 of the thing in wearing a yarmulke and like in his full garb and holding the Torah as like a Hanukkah picture. And it's telling. I mean, the thing was one of the characters that I think he gravitated towards the most. And a lot of people have said that the thing talks the most like Jack Kirby ever did and has the most Kirby DNA, which is maybe telling also about his self-image, but that's a whole other issue to talk about. But it's something that, I mean, would need to be handled with careful sensitivity, but would also, yeah, really inform how does this man grapple with these big questions of good and evil? Because that was always his, you know, since day one, there was a very early comic he did called Mercury, which I haven't been able to find, but it was an 8-page comic about like a god living among mortals. And that sounds like that's Jack Kirby to a T, baby. Like, that's always been the issues he's struggled with, is these massive questions of ethics and faith and how do we plan for a future we cannot see and what is the world to come in a way that does feel very Jewish in a weird way.
But I feel like, yeah, I hadn't seen any evidence of how religious he was or whether he was or wasn't, but I feel like maybe this was how he wrestled with those questions instead of, you know, he didn't go to temple, he went to the comic book, you know, drafting table.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. It would be nice to know if there was a rabbi or someone he could fight it with. Maybe he could create that for the movie. I don't know. Or at least someone he would talk with occasionally.
Yeah, yeah.
There was also an anecdote given in the Marc Evanier. So I should also say most of my information on Jack Kirby comes from the biography of him written by Marc Evanier, who worked with him in his later years. There's an anecdote where Jack Kirby was at some sort of event or benefit by the Los Angeles Public Library, and some librarian asked him if he thought that comics mirrored reality. And he says, no, comics transcend reality. And I feel like that is sort of the perfect Jack Kirby question, you know, and answer too. Like that's how he understood it, is you don't seek to understand the mystery. You seek to make the mystery larger and try to live in it. And it's, I don't know, there's something bracing about that. There's something truly exciting about that. I feel like his work remains so interesting and vital, not because it's goofy or because it, you know, is prescient, but because it speaks to an underlying truth that's really still relevant and is still interesting in a way that people have still grappled with. One of the other things I was thinking about is, are there any other creators who still are sort of dealing with questions in the same way that Kirby did? And probably the closest is Grant Morrison, who famously has worked on some of Jack Kirby's characters. He did a bunch of stuff with the Fourth World characters. I don't know how much you get into modern comics. I don't know if the name's familiar.
I know Grant Morrison.
His approach to creating and his approach to engaging with huge ethical questions and huge notions of monstrous reality, that's more in fitting with the spirit of Jack Kirby than probably anybody else. Well, anyone else in the mainstream, at least. I don't know enough about indie creators who might be working with those questions, but I feel
the
like
thing his, is if you can find indie creators, I'm sure, who deal with, you know, philosophical issues and put those in their comics, but nobody's done on such a large scale or had such an impact on the American landscape as Jack Kirby.
Yeah. And also, I mean, one of the other advantages of film is you can also see the work we're talking about, because it's probably a little difficult to understand if you've only familiar with Jack Kirby through this podcast, what his art looks like. I encourage you, if you can, go out and look at some of his works, because it is truly monumentally brilliant the way that he creates these figures and the way they just leap out at you, and the colors and the design and the just the overall feel of it is electric.
So. And going back to director, I think you could, you know, a good director can find a way to bring that to sort of to life on screen.
Yeah. Cause it's, yeah, none of it is as personal as like Harvey Pekar's struggles were, but they're relevant. And there's certainly questions that he dealt with in his personal life too, that those characters can be mirrored in his work or vice versa, that in his life, that in a way that could be really interesting when put on film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think that's our movie.
Yeah. Wow.
So thanks again to Ted Anderson. If you have any thoughts on Jack Kirby or ideas for the movies that need to get made, hit us up on Twitter at YMovie. You can find my column, Wiki Wormhole, in the AV Club every Sunday. And you can hear Real College Radio and read articles on our parent website, subjectmedia.org. You can find Ted's comics at Boom Studios, IDW, Aftershock, wherever comics are sold. Do you have any social media you want to plug?
Yes, I'm on Twitter and a lot of other places, usually as Tedley Anderson, T-E-D-L-Y. It's a college nickname. I have a book coming out later this year called The Spy Who Raised Me. That's a YA graphic novel. And another one probably by the end of the year that I don't think I can talk about yet. But I'm always creating more, and I may have more announcements soon. So I would appreciate a follow. You know, I talk about things occasionally.
All right. Well, thanks again for coming. Stay safe out there. Wear a mask. Wash your hands. Keep yourself sane. We'll be back next time on
Why is this not a moon?